Let's turn to Luke chapter 9. In Luke chapter 9, we're going to have some lessons. In fact, this whole section has been devoted to Jesus teaching lessons to his disciples. Remember, we're in a transition period, and that transition goes from chapter 9 and verse 18 down to the end of the chapter in verse 50, and we hope to finish that up this evening. Remember, Jesus is still among the multitudes. He's still in the crowds, but his teaching is kind of narrowing down now to the disciples alone. And we'll see that this evening when everybody is marveling at his miracles. He's going to say, "Now you guys, listen up." And he's talking to the disciples alone there. So we'll see him narrow down in who he's talking to and how that emphasis is shifting. Remember, there's seven major events that take place during this transition. First is Peter's confession in 9:18 through 20. And then the first prediction of his, that is Christ's, death and resurrection in 21 through 27. And then in 28 through 36, we have the transfiguration, and that's where we left off last time. And we'll see how that goes right in to the healing of a boy. And the two are connected. They don't look connected, but they are. And I'll show you why when we get there. And then after the boy's healing, he makes a second prediction of his death and suffering. And all this time, he's talking about this demon-possessed boy, and it's just a terrible story. He's talking about his death that's imminent, his suffering that's imminent. And what are the disciples doing? They're sitting talking among themselves. Well, who do you think is going to be the greatest in the kingdom? Will it be me or you? And that's kind of the feeling you get from reading this section. If you read it all over as a whole, and Jesus rebukes them seriously. I mean, you know, come on, guys. I'm talking about dying on the cross, and you're wondering who's the greatest? It gets almost silly. And then in verse 49 and 50, there will be a principle for the disciples. So now let's move on to the healing of a demon-possessed boy. We just finished the transfiguration. Now we're going to move to this demon-possessed boy in verse 37 through 43. Let's read those verses. In verse 37 it says, "And all the people of the country of the Gerasenes and the surrounding district asked him to leave them." I'm in chapter 8, of course. How about chapter 9? Verse 37, "On the next day, when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. And a man from the crowd shouted, saying, 'Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only boy.' And a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly screams, and it throws him into convulsion with foaming at the mouth. And only with difficulty does it leave him, mauling him as it leaves. I begged your disciples to cast it out, and they could not. And Jesus answered and said, 'You unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you and put up with you? Bring your son here.' And while he was still approaching, the demon slammed him to the ground and threw him into a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God." So you see, this boy is in very bad shape. I mean, this is a very, very sad story. Now, on your handouts, and it would be on the screen, I ordered my new computer today. It should be here tomorrow or the next day. I got a big one this time. It's not a laptop. It fills my whole office in there. No, not quite that big. But anyway, what you would be seeing on the screen is this painting by Raphael. This painting is called The Transfiguration, and it depicts the sequence of events that's happening here in Luke chapter 9. And you can't really catch it. I know that's a very bad reproduction that you have there. But Luke 9, 28 through 36, that we just finished last week, depicts the magnificent glory of the transfiguration. You know, Jesus shone from within. His garments glowed from without. It was just beautiful. Everything light. Everything beautiful. And now, in verse 37, the scene changes from that to a demon-possessed boy. So it goes from lightness to total confusion. I mean, this boy is in terrible shape. And the contrast on what happened on the Mount of Transfiguration and what was happening on the earth below, that's what Raphael's trying to capture in this painting. And that's why if you can look at that painting, you see the top half of the canvas is very light. You see it, you can see that even on the black and white painting. It's light and beautiful. The lower half shows confusion. And that's the contrast that Luke is making here. That's how these two sections are connected together, actually. There's the transfiguration is the glory of heaven, and then he goes right into the cursed earth, so to speak. He puts them side by side. And Raphael tried to capture that. That's why I like that painting so well, is because I think he did a pretty good job. He shows the light above and the confusion below. But before the journey that Jesus will take to Jerusalem, Luke is going to focus in on four more events, four different events. First, the demon-possessed boy, and this is the contrast to the transfiguration. And then Jesus' second prediction of his suffering. The argument that the disciples are having over who's the greatest, and a man casting out demons in verse 49 and 50. Now, in each of these incidents, Jesus is going to focus in on one fault of the disciples in each incident. He's going to focus in on a fault that they have. Remember, these guys are believers. We're talking not about salvation here. We're talking about service, because these men are disciples. They are his official representatives here on the earth. So in verse 37 through 39, we have the tragedy of the boy. And it's really a two-part tragedy. The first part is this. Verse 37, on the next day, they came down from the mountain. A large crowd met him. And a man from the crowd shouted, saying, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only boy." And a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly screams, and it throws him into convulsion with foaming at the mouth. And only with difficulty does it leave him, mauling him as it leaves. Now that's tragic. It's his only son, and he has to watch this. I mean, just try to picture that in your mind. This is very tragic. He was his only son. He was a demoniac. He was possessed by a demon. He was deaf and dumb. Look at Mark chapter 9, talking about the same event over in Mark chapter 9, verse 17. It says that, "And one of the crowd answered him, 'Teacher, I brought you my son, possessed with a spirit which makes him mute.'" Verse 25 says, "When Jesus saw that a crowd was rapidly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, 'You deaf and mute spirit, I command you, come out of him and do not enter him again.'" So he was deaf and dumb as well as being demoniac. He was called a lunatic in Matthew. Look at Matthew 17. So try to think of this poor kid's condition as we go through here. And in the back of your mind, as we're thinking of this kid's condition, think about the disciples arguing over which one of them is the greatest. I mean, here's this kid who's having all this trouble. And that's the focus of this. That's what Jesus is going to say. And you guys, you better listen up. You're not getting the picture at all. You're not getting the picture. You should do something about this. Take care of this. Don't argue among yourselves about how cool you are. My gosh, that would be like us seeing a car accident and just standing on the curb saying, I think my shoes are neater than yours, you know, and not doing a thing. That's the idea, is that, you know, come on, guys, get with the picture. So in Matthew 17 and verse 15, it says, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is a lunatic. And lunatic is seleniadzomai. Seleniadzomai is a word in Greek that means to experience epileptic seizures. To experience epileptic seizures. So not necessarily what we would think of as a lunatic. I'm not sure about why they translated that way. But that's what the word actually means. Remember, the authors of the Gospels always made a distinction between demon possession and illness. You know, they cast out demons and they healed. Most people will say, oh, those crazy pre-scientific, they'd call them. Not unscientific, but pre-scientific. They didn't know the difference. They thought when somebody had a seizure, that meant he had a demon in him. Well, the disciples always made the distinction. He's either ill or he's got a demon, one or the other. But that doesn't mean they can't be connected, as we see here. He's having seizures. Why is he having seizures? That would seem like a physical illness. Well, he's having seizures because he's possessed by a demon. What's the second part of the tragedy? Well, go back to Luke chapter 9. Chapter 9, verse 1. Says, and he called the 12 together. Remember, the 12 were the apostles. These are the disciples, not just the multitudes, the disciples. He called the 12 together and gave them power and authority over all the demons and to heal diseases. He gave them the power over demons. And if you look down at verse 6, departing, they began going throughout the villages, preaching the Gospels and healing. Successful. Verse 10 says, when the apostles returned, they gave an account to him of all they had done, taking them with him. He withdrew by himself. So they were successful. And he had given them the power to heal sickness. He had given them the power to cast out demons. They were successful at doing it, but they didn't do it to the boy. So in 41, we have Jesus' response. Look at verse 40. The guy even said, I begged your disciples to cast it out, and they could not. Why couldn't they cast out the demon? Well, I think they were too busy arguing over which one was the best. We don't have time for that. You know, we're having a deep theological discussion here. We don't have time to help anybody. That's my view on it anyway. So Jesus, what does he say to him in verse 41? And verse 41 can be taken one of two different ways. Verse 41 says, and Jesus answered and said, you unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you and put up with you? Bring your son here. Now you could take that to be to everybody there, you know, the father, the disciples, the crowd, or you could take it to be just the disciples. And that's kind of the way I lean. Look at Matthew 17, because the disciples had, they just messed up here. There's no question about it. They messed up. And we all mess up. I'm not going to be too hard on them, because, you know, there's obviously many incidents in my background that would match this same circumstance. So I'm not going to be hard on them, but I am going to say they messed up like we all do. And in Matthew 17 and verse 16, it says, talking about the same incidents, I brought him to your disciples and they could not cure him. Again, and Jesus answered and said, "You unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him here to me." So the disciples couldn't help. They were busy. Now Jesus says, okay, bring the kid here. And in verse 41, he says, bring your son here. We're back in Luke 9 now. He says, in verse 41, he says, bring your son here. Now, why does he say that? He come up and say, bring your son here, and I'll see if maybe there's something I can do that they couldn't do. That's not what he's saying at all. He's saying, bring your son here, and I will do something. And that's exactly his promise. He will do something. Now, the encounter is recorded in verses 42 and 43. Verse 42 says, while he was still approaching, the demon slammed him to the ground and threw him into a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. So you see there the link between the demon and the healing. So he had two problems. This poor boy had two problems. He was demon-possessed and he was sick as well. And so Jesus took care of both of them. Immediately, as always, no recovery time. He just completely cured the boy, cast out the demon, and said, go back to your dad. Interesting, the word slammed. That word slammed is a word that was used of a boxer knocking an opponent down. So it wasn't, he just kind of flopped him on the ground. He laid him down good. It was used of a wrestler throwing an opponent. And you see what happens is here comes Jesus walking along, and the closer he gets, the more intense the demonic activity becomes. So whenever Jesus is around, they just get absolutely, totally furious. Doesn't do them any good. It's futile, but it's fierce. So this kid is getting kind of their last licks, as you could say, because they knew what was going to happen. They knew they couldn't defeat Jesus, so they said, okay, we'll get our last licks on this kid, and they slammed him to the ground. Well, Jesus came along and told them to get out of Dodge, and that's what they did. You see the contrast between the transfiguration. Everything is light, everything is beautiful, everything is orderly, and then you come back down the mountain, and everything is total pandemonium. Here's a kid running around with a demon flopping around on the ground like a fish out of water, I would imagine. And it's a very unpleasant scene. And that's what Raphael was trying to depict in that painting. Now in verse 43, the second part down through verse 45, Jesus gives a second prediction of his suffering. Remember, he had given a first one that we looked at before. And now in verse 43, it says, but while everyone was marveling at all that he was doing, he said to his disciples, let these words sink into your ears, for the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. But they did not understand the statement, and it was concealed from them so that they would not perceive it. And they were afraid to ask him about this statement. So the argument, the second prophecy now, draws his disciples' attention away from the marveling to his coming suffering and death. Everybody is marveling, and he says, you guys, you 12, you know, I want you to listen up now, because I have something to say to you. In fact, the word you, in verse 44, let these words sink into your ears, that word your is emphatic. He's talking to just the disciples now, not everybody. He's being emphatic. You listen up. Now, he's not talking about the crowd. The phrase, let these words sink into your ears, that means pay attention. And we use that same figure of speech ourselves sometimes, you know. Well, that didn't quite sink in. He's telling them, I want this to sink in. So Here's the crowd then. They're marveling at the miracles. That's all they're doing. The disciples are supposed to learn something from this. Jesus is teaching them. And the point he's making is that his death is necessary for his messiahship. His death is necessary for his messiahship. Verse 44 says, "Let these words sink into your ears, for the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men." Now, they didn't understand that. And put yourself in their place. Here you are, a disciple. You've grown up in Judaism. You're a disciple of Jesus. He claimed to be Messiah. Now, what were you taught from the minute you could understand Hebrew, understand language, to your adult life? The Messiah is coming to free us from Roman domination, just like Moses freed us from Egypt. You hear that all your life and all your life, and here comes Jesus and said, "I am the Messiah, I have to suffer and die." Do you see how hard that would be to grasp for these guys? I mean, we kind of give them a bum rap, I think, sometimes. Well, can't they believe that? Don't they see that? Well, gosh, they'd learned their whole lives that, you know, they concentrated on the passages where Messiah was king, where he came in glory, where he was going to free them, not the passages where he was going to suffer, you know. And in fact, they even translated those passages to be referring to someone other than Messiah or nation Israel as a whole. They didn't even see that in the Old Testament. So here are these disciples, and Jesus just told them twice that he's going to suffer and die. So they didn't truly grasp that concept until after the cross. And that's obvious as we go through the gospel accounts, that these guys didn't grasp that fact. Now, in verse 46 through 50, we got to start talking about the argument, and that's the test of greatness I have in my Bible. In verse 46, it says, "An argument started among them as to which of them might be the greatest. But Jesus, knowing that they were thinking in their heart, took a child and stood him by his side. And he said to them, 'Whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For the one who is least among all of you, this is the one who is great.' And John answered and said, 'Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him because he does not follow along with us.' But Jesus said to him, 'Do not hinder him, for he who is not against you is for you.'" See how preoccupied the disciples seem to be about their own importance? Here they are. Jesus is trying to teach them something with this child. And they say, "Well, we saw a guy casting out demons, and he's not one of us. You know, go turn him into a pillar of smoke or something." It's kind of the idea you get there. And can you imagine the absolute gall of these disciples? Because Jesus had just told them he was going to die for sins. He was going to make a sacrificial death for sinners. And they're arguing about who's the greatest. You know, it's kind of a no-brainer who's the greatest there. It's Jesus. It's none of them. They were arguing about their pride of their positions. An argument started among them. The word arguing is actually a word that can mean thought or reasoning. It's the word dialogismos. We get the English word dialogue from it. They were having a dialogue. They were having a discussion group on who is the greatest disciple while all this other stuff was going on. I want to read a quote, and this is by a guy named Ryle. And he said this, "Of all creatures, none has so little right to be proud as man. And of all men, none ought to be so humble as the Christian." Because the Christian is supposed to know how sinful and we are. And here's the disciples, and they're arguing over who's the greatest. And what do you think Paul would say about that? Who's accumulated the greatest pile of dung? Which one of you guys is the best at accumulating dung? It means nothing. None of them are the best. And as a matter of fact, in 47 and 48, the rebuke, it says, "But Jesus, knowing that they were thinking in their heart, took a child and stood him by his side." Now, the child here just represents the helpless, unimportant, just a little street urchin, a Baker Street irregular. I'll get one smile out of that, I know. Just a little street urchin, you know, he's just a kid. And he says, and he takes him and he says to them, "Whoever receives this child in my name receives me." And so forth. So the test of loving service is if we receive the unimportant in the name of Christ. The helpless, the unimportant. Now this isn't a test of salvation. We're talking about service here. Okay? And he's saying a test of true service is, do you only give service to the wealthy people, you know? Only witness to the people who you think you might be able to get something in return from? Or is that a complete non-issue, as it was with Jesus? He doesn't say who's the best. He never says, well, one of you is going to be higher than in rank than all the others. And why is that? Because in service, people don't compare themselves with one another. That's tough. It's hard to do, especially for a guy in my position. It's hard not to compare with somebody else, you know, especially when he's looking at me from back there all the time. But I can't. I can't. I do what I do, you know, and I can't compare myself with anybody else, nor can any of you. It just doesn't matter. We do what we do. We don't try to, well, I'm going to have the highest position. Now, that doesn't mean we can't try with every resource we have at availability to be the best that we can be, but it just means the best that I can be is the best that I can be, and that's what I'm after. I'm not trying to be better than somebody else. I'm just trying to be the best I can be. And I can spend a lot of time on that. Now, in verse 49 and 50, we get the idea that the disciples still don't see the picture. Verse 49 says, "John answered and said, 'Master, we saw one casting out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him because he does not follow along with us.' But Jesus said to him, 'Do not hinder him, for he who is not against you is for you.'" So verse 49 and 50 show they're still worried about rank and position. They're saying, these guys over here are casting out demons and they're not following us. You know, they're not following our orders. And in their minds, he didn't have the proper credentials to cast out demons, this other guy, because they weren't following the 12. So in verse 50, Jesus sets them straight. And he says, don't hinder him. You know, he's got his ministry, you've got yours. Don't compare yourself. Don't worry about his credentials. You do everything possible to make your ministry the very best it can be. And don't worry about other people's ministries. Okay, we'll pick up then. Next week, we'll have a major shift in the emphasis of the book of Luke, and it's going to be the road to Jerusalem. Now we're going to start heading for Jerusalem and the transition period from talking to the crowds in general to the disciples in particular is now at an end. And Jesus is now headed for Jerusalem and he's headed for suffering and death. Father, thank you for your word and thank you for this section that we have in the book of Luke that tells us what you taught your disciples about service, and we pray that we can use that example for our service as well. And we pray in Christ's name, amen.